regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed.
185,000 pages.
Now, public accountability and transparency, there will be no public support.
Is this really the best we can do?
If there's a regulation that doesn't make any sense, why do you keep
it? Do you know who wrote the regulatory laws you must comply with?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Fourth Branch Podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. My name is Colton Grob. I'm the Deputy Director of RTP. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the guest speakers on today's call. If you'd like to learn more about each of them and their work, you can visit regproject.org, where we have their full bios. After opening remarks and discussion between our panelists, we will go to audience Q&A. So please be thinking of the questions you'd like to ask our speakers. This afternoon, we're pleased to host a conversation discussing the recent uptick in cybersecurity threats against U.S. companies and infrastructure assets and the regulatory response to these threats. We're pleased to welcome two distinguished speakers to discuss the implications of this topic. Stuart Baker is a partner at the firm of Steptoe & Johnson. Prior to joining the firm, Stuart served as the general counsel of the NSA and the first assistant secretary for policy at the Department of Homeland Security. He's joined by Tatiana Bolton, as policy director for the Cybersecurity and Emerging Threats Team at the R Street Institute. Before joining R Street, Tatiana served as senior policy director for the U.S. Cyberspace Solarian Commission and at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency as the cyber policy lead in the Office of Strategy, Policy, and Plans. Stuart and Tatiana, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Colton.
Thanks for having us.
So do you want to kick off the discussion by telling us about the most recent cyber attacks?
Yeah, it's been I won't call it productive, but it's been a busy time in the last 6 months. Not only busy in terms of attacks, but busy in terms of policy responses to those attacks. The two most obvious ones are SolarWinds and the Colonial Pipeline JBS ransomware. Since SolarWinds came first, I thought I'd introduce that, and we can talk a little bit about how the policy machinery responded to that. It's kind of odd and hard to remember exactly what happened with SolarWinds because it's two or three incidents back, but it was a big deal just at the turn of the year. It was actually still on the Trump administration's watch, but the Biden administration knew they were going to own the response. And so I actually think that the Biden administration probably had a chance to do some more thinking about this before they actually took office. And that may in part account for the comprehensiveness of their response. But the incident itself was pretty quickly attributed by the intelligence community to Russian intelligence. It was a supply chain attack, which is an enormously productive but hard attack to pull off, in which you first find somebody whose products are valuable and widely used by the targets that you have in mind. You go after that company, you modify its products to make them easier to hack. When they are updated and sent to all of your true targets, you have an easy way in. That's what Russian intelligence did to SolarWinds. They modified SolarWinds products, and then the update occurred. They had access to thousands of computers. I think the Russians don't often get credit for restraint, but they did show restraint here. They did not compromise everybody who got the update. They seem to have been pretty selective in their targets. That's not necessarily a sign of virtue. It may just be a sign that they are wise, that if you compromise everybody, you're going to get caught. And if you compromise a few people, you might be able to run the operation for a lot longer. But they did run it for a while, and they were not found by SolarWinds. They were found by FireEye, which in kind of a remarkable, this is a story that tells you how cybersecurity really works in the real world. One guy at FireEye who was in charge, who had a security role, saw a very low priority anomaly, a person asking for a second phone to be used as an authentication device. And he called him up to ask him why he needed two phones to authenticate. And the guy said, I didn't ask for a second phone. And that answer started to unwind the entire operation. FireEye figured out how he had gotten, the Russians had gotten in to be able to make that request. They notified SolarWinds. They also notified the government, and the government began looking around. Treasury, Microsoft, both discovered that they had been compromised. DHS had been compromised. The response was generally to say, we had no idea this was happening. And as far as we can tell, people who knew about it as much as 6 weeks in advance didn't say anything. They just quietly fixed their own problems. There was a lot of criticism of SolarWinds on the ground that they had not prioritized security. Instead, they had been sort of slowly milking their franchise. They had a SolarWinds 123 password that had been disclosed. So there was a general sense that SolarWinds, considering the significance of its product to a lot of high priority intelligence targets, hadn't lived up to its end of the responsibility bargain. And that produced an immediate reaction on the part of DHS, which issued a binding directive telling people to, telling other agencies, civilian agencies, to disable SolarWinds software. And then we got the government's response in the form of an executive order on May 12th. I'm happy to talk about that. But Tatiana, if you want to talk about that or other policy responses, this would be a good time.
Well, yeah, let me get into that in one second. But I think that we also wanted to kind of touch on what happened with Colonial Pipeline and the attack there. So let me introduce that, and then let's immediately jump into the executive actions that happened after all of these cyber attacks. So not only did we have the SolarWinds hack, at the end of last year, but arguably, really happened in March of 2020, perhaps even earlier. But we also then had the Microsoft Exchange hack. And then in the recent past, last month, we had the Colonial Pipeline attack. And so what happened there, unlike the SolarWinds hack, which was a supply chain compromise, this was a directed ransomware attack by a criminal group called DarkSide, which is sort of a conglomeration of a bunch of hackers that work together in a sort of a pay-to-play system where they're part of this group and they provide services to each other, or there's an organizing group that manages payments and services, and some hackers offer services, some hackers buy services. So this group, DarkSide, theoretically working within the borders of Russia again, attacked and blocked Colonial Pipeline's internet facing systems their IT systems. So I want to be clear that the attack wasn't on the actual systems that ran their fuel pipelines up and down the East Coast, but because of the way that a lot of companies run their systems, because of the lack of strict firewalls or separations and air gaps between the IT systems of computers and billing and payments and all of that with their operational systems that actually turn fuel on and off, they shut down all of it. And that's why we had half of the East Coast without gas, or, you know, panic buying at the pump, putting gas into, coolers and plastic bags, and generally, panicking about whether we would have gas to fill our cars in the next week. And then that went on for about a week. What happened is, as DarkSide blocked all access for Colonial Pipeline to get into their computer systems, Colonial Pipeline immediately paid a ransom, almost immediately paid a ransom of somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 million to DarkSide. And the payment, unfortunately, didn't get them back enough of their information to actually restart services. And also, because of the attack and because of obviously now a known vulnerability in their systems, they still had to take certain steps and took some time for them to get back online, which is why you saw gas shortages starting, because even though they paid the ransom almost immediately, that is sort of a lesson to all of us that even though ransoms get paid, even though they're illegal, technically, that doesn't necessarily mean that companies won't be affected or consumers won't be affected by ransomware attacks. And we've seen the rise of those in the last 6 months to a year. It's become such a significant issue that CISA, the Cybersecurity Agency, as well as DHS and the White House have labeled ransomware sort of the biggest threat to national security in cyberspace. So you see, as back to Stuart's point, not only are you seeing sort of the EO and you're seeing these binding operational directives, BODs, as we call them, but you're also seeing action within the executive agencies and on the Hill to try and address some of these bigger issues like ransomware and supply chain through interagency groups. They're trying to pull together all the different agencies that work together on cybersecurity and criminal activity, like the FBI, CISA, the intelligence agencies, Commerce, Treasury, to try and address all of these issues. And there are a lot of them. So, you know, you're seeing a lot of different things crop up on supply chain security, on ransomware task force. You're seeing a lot of different action. So I'll stop there.
So I think stepping back and asking what came out of these incidents, the principal thing that came out of the SolarWinds incident was the executive order. And it was mainly, although not exclusively, aimed at government, other agencies, and at government contractors. The notion, well, I've just discovered that SolarWinds and a whole bunch of other things are part of the government's supply chain, and we have no idea how much vulnerability that creates. And probably the biggest impact on contractors was mandatory notification of cybersecurity incidents to CISA, or CISA, as I tend to call it. I know that CISA would prefer to be called that. I've said if you want to be called CISA, you need another S in your name. And since they've got cyber cyber, they've got security in there twice. They'd have to have it in there three times. But in any event,
I'll go with what the former director Chris Krebs always called it, which is
he always calls it CISA. I think CISA is better, but we can all agree to disagree. Exactly. CISA was not getting notice of these things. In some cases, there were contractual provisions saying, we'll tell the FBI because we have a contract with you and we won't tell anybody else. Or there's no provision at all. And the agent of the contractor didn't have to tell anybody. So this imposes a mandatory notification requirement. And I will say, I think it has made mandatory notification of cybersecurity incidents the flavor of the year. We're going to see a lot of that. In fact, we've already seen that at Treasury, which has a reg out that they're pursuing, telling financial institutions to do it. Tatiana, I think cybersecurity Solarium also has proposals for notification of cyber incidents, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So from the commission's perspective, notification of breach reporting was one of the biggest, it was one of the biggest stumbling blocks to an improved cybersecurity posture across the country and the world. Because if you don't know when something has happened, when a breach has happened and a vulnerability exists, you can't fix it. And so you're right that there are certain agencies that are taking proactive steps to try and use their existing regulatory authority to require reporting, and the EO does that for federal agencies and their contractors. The commission recommended that a national data breach reporting law be passed through the Hill because, you know, we need, CISA needs a broader, and so does the FBI, to be quite honest, a broader sense of the threats and vulnerabilities to our ecosystem. And we can't have that when we have very little reporting and very little sort of transparency, even between agencies, let alone between the private sector and the public sector. So, you know, when like CISA, for example, has a reporting mechanism through their CISA Central, what used to be called NCIC or US CERT, where companies could report incidents to the federal government. But there's a lot, there are a lot of problems with that system. One, because companies don't feel comfortable sharing because of liability concerns, even though there was legislation passed in 2015 providing liability protection for companies for reporting cybersecurity incidents. So liability protection exists. However, that still wasn't sufficient impetus for companies to share that information with the government. And so I'm a big believer that national reporting law is critical because voluntary reporting has not proven sufficient to get the appropriate level of visibility into the threats that exist in cyberspace to address them.
So Tatiana, the one, I don't disagree with that. I think we do need to know this. There are some issues about the details of this. DoD's had mandatory reporting of cyber incidents for a while, and I've worked with clients on that, and it feels a little like the closing scenes in Raiders of the Lost Ark. You send your report in and it disappears. It's not clear what the government is doing or that the government is really well set up to respond in a method that reassures the people making the report that they've actually been heard and somebody's thinking about the problem.
Well, I agree. I think that not only do we need national reporting requirements, but I think that there's a significant push that needs to happen to invest in CISA and their capabilities to respond to incidents, to engage with the private sector. Because the example you're using right here with DoD is the perfect example of precisely why the system is broken. you can't report incidents to DOD, cyber incidents to DOD, and expect DOD to coordinate with CISA, who's the actual cybersecurity agency, mm-hmm. right? And this is what I repeatedly, what we repeatedly heard at the commission and at CISA as well, is that I used to work there before the commission, is that there's no one-stop shop for a company to sort of engage with the federal government on cybersecurity incidents. And let's not even bring up state and locals, right? But you've got a system where there's 18,000 doors in, and inside is a maze of regulation and bureaucracy and and missed communications and an agency, CISA, which is barely trying to get off the ground and is underfunded, under-resourced, and doesn't have enough people to do the job that it needs to do.
And so I do think that the major thrust of the executive order from May was to elevate CISA to the status that NSA has in DOD cybersecurity. And that's a big deal. It is on its way to saying, look, we have a CISO for the civilian sector, and it is CISA. They're going to tell you what you have to do. They're going to have the authority to go into your network and hunt threats, to see what's going on your network and look for anomalies and report them and act on them. Those are things that every other agency fought for decades. And most of those barriers have been swept away. And the question now is, can CISA actually do the things that it's been authorized to do?
Well, I really hope so. I mean, obviously, Jen Easterly recently got passed through the Senate on her way to full confirmation, passed through committee and onto full Senate confirmation for her role as the new CISA director. And she's got excellent credentials and fantastic experience in both the private sector and the public sector working on cybersecurity threats. So I have the utmost respect for her and her expertise in order to try and lead CISA in this next phase of its growth. Right now, as it stands, CISA faces a number of challenges, authorities being one, but resources being the biggest, in my opinion. And I think that what you're pointing to is just the lack of resources. CISA is not only supposed to be the intaker of all cyber reporting, but also the responder and the trainer and the federal cybersecurity agency, the integrator with the private sector. So as you can see, like, the agency is wearing so many different hats. And as these incidents keep increasing, I think that, you see more and more of a need for CISA to be better resourced. DOD's got $700+ billion a year, right, for DOD, for our national defense. And as cybersecurity is part of our national defense, I think it definitely deserves more funding than $2 billion a year as a portion of that giant DOD budget, right? I mean, it's not within the DOD budget, but I just, point that out as a comparison.
Yeah, I sometimes say that if you were being generous, you would have said that 5 years ago, CISA's performance was C-, that Chris Krebs raised its reputation to about a B and its performance to about a C+. But we're a long way from having really strong performances from CISA, largely because of resource constraints and resource in the sense of not having people who have made it their career to do this kind of cybersecurity in the government. They're going to fail again. They're going to need more resources to address those failures. But they are at least credible as the recipient of those resources and as somebody who should be carrying out those responsibilities.
I agree. I mean, I think that we've seen from the experiences of Estonia, the United Kingdom, and Israel, in terms of some of our allies that are good on cybersecurity, that strong leadership and a resourced, centralized cybersecurity agency is one of the keys to improving your cybersecurity across the board. I think you're going to see the importance of the National Cyber Director as Chris Inglis comes in. Again, one of the preeminent recommendations of the commission, because, you know, we saw the leadership of it, the strengthening CISA and improving the workforce as three key pillars of trying to improve cybersecurity. I agree that, listen, CISA is not the DOD. Right. A lot of people within the government, for example, will say, like, well, if you want to do it right, just give it to the DOD. I don't think that's the right answer. Right. I think the right answer is not, giving money to the people who currently can do it well. I think the right answer is not to play kind of favorites, but instead to give the responsibility into the right seats of power that exist within the government that we've created as a structure and resource those people accordingly, invest in them, and then make them rise to that challenge. And I think CISA can, particularly with the movement to a better hiring system, as they're trying to do, because I think that's one of the keys to the success of NSA and CIA, for one, who have unique hiring authorities. And I'm sure you can speak to that more than I can, but those unique hiring authorities and ability to attract some of the best talent is what CISA needs right now, so that it can compete with some of the largest banks, Google and all the tech companies, for that talent, because that's what you're going to need to respond to all these incidents.
So the executive order had a couple of things that additional things that might be important to private sector lawyers. There's a cyber safety review board, kind of like the National Transportation Safety Board, and a requirement, or the aspiration to a requirement, for a software bill of materials for people who are providing software. What do you think the impact of those two things is likely to be?
I have mixed feelings about the sort of cyber NTSB, as it were. I think that a lot of the recommendations that we heard about improving cybersecurity, made reference to the ways in which NTSB and flight regulations exist to report incidents, which has drastically improved the safety of our transportation system, as well as specifically airline safety. I think that there are important parallels there, but I think we need to be cautious in drawing too many parallels. And I'm still interested to see how the federal government will implement that EO and what rules and regulations they will come out with to extend that through the federal government, because it's such a complicated web of agencies that have, different responsibilities in cyber. And we have 16 critical infrastructure sectors, which all respond differently and have different levels of security. And so for example, the financial sector, right, with Treasury as its SSA, that's a sector specific agency, they're very good, right? They're very strong. Same with energy. They have, they have authorities, regulations. They already have some of these reporting requirements. They have certain standards for cybersecurity, although I believe all of them can be improved. But we'll see how this is implemented across those sectors. The proof is going to be in the details of the rules that they put out. Most importantly, I think the federal government needs to focus on the goals and, when setting standards and maturity model frameworks, things like that. I think you need to focus on the goals and not on specific steps that any company or agency or sector needs to take, because that is where the pitfalls are. If you're too specific in those regulations, requiring companies to do specific cybersecurity actions, you may in fact cause problems. You know, Jamil Jaffer was one that made those arguments. He has made those arguments many times.
That compliance is the compliance culture in which you do everything the regulator tells you to do is the enemy of actually meeting security requirements. Yes. Well, fair enough. And if you're looking for a performance requirement, one pretty good one would be, don't let ransomware artists get hold of your network and ring it out, because that you've obviously failed at that point. And it's not for lack of compliance, it's for lack of cybersecurity. So maybe we should just talk a little bit about what came out of the pipeline by way of policy, because that was probably the first time that ordinary Americans took seriously the cybersecurity complaints that they've been hearing from governments since the 90s and said, wow, this really is dangerous. And I would say the first victim of the outrage over the gas lines and the attack was what I have occasionally called TSA's tea and cookies approach to achieving cybersecurity, in which they invite people in, they provide the tea, they provide the cookies, everybody will talk and agree on some voluntary measures to make security better. And if they don't show up, then nobody calls them. That's all gone. That disappeared in part because Colonial Pipeline's response to the to that initiative had been mostly, you know, we're busy in 2018, and actually we're kind of busy in 2019 and 2020, and maybe in 2021 when our new building is done, you can come in and talk to us about cybersecurity. And people said, no, that's not good enough. And TSA has now said they are going to require cyber incident reporting. They've already said that for pipelines. And they're going to start specifying the cybersecurity measures they want to see people adopting. I think the first response of most Americans to all that activity is to say, what? The people who pat me down at the airports are regulating pipeline security? They've had that responsibility. They just haven't had much of a regulatory culture. Interestingly, there's now kind of a turf fight over whether TSA will get to keep that responsibility.
TSA is going to win on that one.
I think they are too, because they have basically admitted that they don't know that much about cybersecurity, and they're going to bring a bunch of CISA people, draft them to help them come up with cybersecurity standards. So we're going to see pretty hefty regulation as TSA demonstrates that it can regulate, and that will fend off, I think, the Commerce Committee, who otherwise would say, hey, why don't we give it to somebody that we have jurisdiction over, like the DOE. So that regulatory impulse hasn't been fully satisfied by TSA's announcements. We're starting to see legislation proposals, enthusiasm for doing more about cryptocurrency, which is seen as a key enabler for this kind of cybercrime. What kinds of legislative changes do you think we're actually going to get, Tatiana?
So, you know, I don't have a magic ball, but I do think that the push from the Solarium Commission last year to get 25 of its recommendations into the NDAA is something similar to what we're going to see this year. And that's sort of the majority of the cyber regulations that we're going to see. I mean, there's good work on the HISGAC and the Senate Armed Services Committee, the House Armed Services Committee, all of them working diligently to try and protect national security, again, of which cybersecurity is part. I think that you're going to see, I think we'll get that national data breach reporting law, or at least I very much hope so. It's a minimum, honestly. It is a minimum to at least know what the threats and vulnerabilities are. I don't think, you know, if you are one that believes that we shouldn't have a national reporting law, then I would venture to say that just like when you don't vote you don't get to complain about the winner. You know, if we don't know what's happening about threats and vulnerabilities and you're not supportive of the federal government knowing that, you can't possibly also expect the federal government to be able to respond appropriately. One of the other things that I think we will see is some debate. I don't know if we're actually going to see it pass, but I think we're going to see some debate around this concept of SICI, systemically important critical infrastructure, and the rules and regulations regarding what you must do if you are a if you are a SICI entity. I know it's the worst acronym in the history of the planet. Trust you, me, me, and some of our some of my good friends at the commission spent a whole day trying to come up with a new one, and the SICI thing stuck, but. The basic concept there is that if you are one of the most critical of the critical, right now there's a Section 9 list, which came out of EO 13636 under the Obama administration, which designated the most critical entities. However, that list is classified, even though companies that are Section 9 entities can talk about the fact that they're Section 9 entities publicly. But the whole list itself, the full list is classified.
Even though the President Biden handed a list of his strategically important industries to President Putin in this latest summit.
Well, I mean, I think he talked about in generalities like the 16 sectors, but yes. The specific entities like, you know, JP Morgan Chase and, you know, other banks and energy companies like Southern and companies like that, you know, the specific list, I think, is still fairly private. Some companies talk about the fact that they're Section 9 entities, and that's fine. But I think what we need to do is actually make that put that into law so that we can talk about what those entities must do to protect the criticality of the services they provide, and then what benefits they're going to receive from the federal government in order to do that. Liability protection is on the table, and I think that the stronger liability protection, particularly in the cases of state actor hacks into their systems, is critical to getting this done. But those companies theoretically will be held to a higher standard. A lot of them, to be honest, already meet these standards, right?
Sure.
Like we're trying to, for example, financial services and energy sector, right? A lot of those entities, a lot of the sector specific agencies that handle the security for those sectors have more regulatory power than other agencies like EPA, for example, that doesn't have any cybersecurity expertise, let alone the, you know, regulatory power to actually improve the cybersecurity of our water sector, for example. But financial services, telecommunications, energy, they already have some ability to protect those. And so you're going to see a big debate about whether the specific pros and cons or the, you know, the benefits and the requirements for those entities will get that piece of legislation through on the Hill this year.
Yeah, so I've noticed that there's been cybersecurity legislation in practically every Congress in the last 10 years, and it tends to follow a pattern that Chris Krebs was a master of, which is the executive branch announces it's going to do something with or without clear authority and starts doing it. And then when Congress is casting about to show that they care about cybersecurity and they've done something, they say, oh, well, you know, the CISA's already doing this and nobody's really complaining. Why don't we just write something that says, hey, do that, CISA? And so as policy has evolved, CISA's gone a long way just by announcing initiatives and then having them ratified by Congress. And we could see some of that happen as well.
We could. I mean, you know, I'll push back a little bit on some of that. I mean, because, you know, if you look at DHS authorization, the last time that was authorized and changes made to DHS and its authorities under which CISA sits, it was back when it was originally stood up in 2003. So, you know, hard pressed for any agency to continue operating without sort of actual reauthorization every year. So I don't hold it against them, right, for trying to move forward and do the good work work of the people as they try to respond to some of these sort of critical issues. But, you know, CISA is very clear in that it doesn't want regulatory authority because it wants to protect, it jealously protects the relationship it has with the private sector, as well it should, because those relationships are the ones that will bear fruit in the long run in terms of protecting our cybersecurity. But I do think you will perhaps see some codification of the authorities that CISA tries to use in order to improve cybersecurity. I doubt that regulatory authority will be in there. CISA will fight that tooth and nail.
I think the last CISA would have fought that. I am not at all convinced. When you look at what TSA did, that's what you have to do at the end of the day. So I guess I am, they may take away my Republican Party membership card for this, but I do think if you want industry to truly have a public-private partnership with you, you've got to have a stick in the closet, and regulation is the stick.
Perhaps. I mean, you know, obviously a lot of the other countries across the world, the ones I mentioned earlier, Israel, UK, Estonia, all have strict regulatory authorities within their cyber agencies. But we are just not set up that same way. And so while CISA is the sector specific agency for a number, I think it's like 8 or 9 of those sectors, it still wants to sort of allow other areas of either DHS like TSA or other SSAs like Energy, Treasury, DOD, EPA to be the regulatory authority, or FTC, right, has been proposed, SEC for some of the telecommunications regulations, to use those authorities instead of bringing in CISA to be a regulatory watchdog over certain agencies, because the way that they see their role, and you're right, perhaps it will change under a Jen Easterly leadership, under Jen Easterly's leadership. But generally, they see themselves as the nation's risk manager, and the connection to the private sector, the sort of the go-between, and sort of cybersecurity experts in the government, right? So they're trying to keep kind of a one foot out the door of the whole requirements game. Because if you are seen as an expert and regulatory agency, just providing your expertise and your knowledge, like, for example, NIST, right? More people, CISA believes more people will listen to you when you provide recommendations than if you are also the hammer that comes down if you don't meet those requirements.
So if we're going to want to take some questions, but there are two things that I thought we probably ought to talk at least briefly about. One was the attack that was every bit as bad. It was an attack on the supply chain going in, compromising Microsoft's Exchange product. It was done by China, not by Russia, although there hasn't been a formal attribution, which is interesting by itself. And the Chinese behavior when they got caught and Microsoft patched the hole, China's reaction to that, Chinese intelligence reaction to that, was to say, oh, you're going to make it hard for us to get into Exchange servers? Why don't we get into all of them now? And they just released a capability as just a storm of compromises on people they had no interest in actually exploiting, just because they could and they saw the door closing. Very irresponsible. I don't hold up Russia as a model of responsibility, but in this case, it looked a lot better compared to China. And the government response to that has been crickets. Nobody's talking about it. Nobody's saying we need to do something about it. We need to confront the Chinese over it. Nothing. I don't get it.
It's a really a really challenging and interesting case. The whole attribution, sort of global power competition between these, you know, sort of these great powers is also always playing in the background of all of these cybersecurity incidents, right? So I think that what we're seeing play out here, and I could be completely wrong, is that the United States has a much different perspective on China, what they're trying to do, which is, to be fair, mostly intelligence gathering, to what Russia's trying to do, right? Like Russia is trying to infiltrate you've seen them hack elections, electrical grid, attack SolarWinds and get specific intel to use against the United States and specific people and specific companies. So there's a difference there. I think the United States is sort of seeing the Microsoft Exchange attack like they did the OPM attack, perhaps, where, you know, there's bigger things happening with China and they're perhaps unwilling to take the same steps of attribution and retribution towards China, given the tense relationship we have at this point. It is crazy that there was such a large hack right after the SolarWinds hack got announced, and we've heard so little about it.
So last question before we take questions we just had the Biden-Putin summit. They talked about cyber. As we said, the president suggested that Putin not attack 16 sectors and handed them a list. What do you think actually was accomplished on cybersecurity at the summit? And I think expectations were pretty low. So I'm not suggesting that a failure to accomplish a lot would be a surprise.
Yeah, well, I'd also like to get your thoughts on how Biden did on the summit and how far we've come on cybersecurity. But my position is that I think we need to be far more aggressive with Russia, particularly because Russians only understand strength. I say this as someone who was born in Russia and raised in the culture within the United States, but still in that culture. And I think that it's safe to say that the previous interactions we've had with Russia were not sufficient to prevent them from doing these hacks and attacking our country. And so we need to be stronger and we need to have a different policy towards them. I think, the comment that was was focused on that Biden said about, how would you feel if your oil pipelines were attacked? Right. A lot of people took that as a threat. But I think that, and Biden denied that it was a threat. But I think that what you're seeing is sort of the beginnings of some of these interactions where hopefully the United States is giving subtle but clear rules of the road to Russia. They're trying to set red lines. They're trying to be clear, although to be honest, in the cyberspace, there's not really red lines. And it's questionable as to what we would mean by those. I'm hopeful that some of these subtle but clear messages will be picked up by Putin, who I think knows exactly what Biden is saying there.
Yeah, he also did say, the U.S. has some very strong capabilities. There's a message in that. Right. What I worry is that the message is, and will we use them? Because I'm not sure we will. And if you'll forgive me a personal story, in the early 90s, right after Gorbachev took over, I helped briefly start the Steptoe and Johnson Russia Moscow office. And we had an office manager who was a very smart guy. And I relied on him and gave him a lot of space and a lot of respect. And he I was just surprised at how insubordinate and contemptuous he seemed to be of the things I suggested he do. And then finally, at one point, I got angry and I called him into my office and I said, "You ever do something like that again, you'll never work here. You're out." And immediately after that, he was the most pleasant person to work with I have ever dealt with in Russia. It really was. He had to see the stick in the closet to decide that I was a person worthy of respect. It is deep in the Russian soul that the right response to weakness is to crush it. And I worry that we can talk about the rules of the road, but if we're not enforcing them, the Russians are going to figure it out in 20 minutes. And we have yet to decide we're willing to take risks of an attack against us in order to enforce these rules. So I think we're in for years of trouble on that front until we decide, okay, this is it. We know it could mean problems for us at home, but we've got to show the Putin that there are consequences he can't handle for attacking us. All right, Colton, do we want to take questions?
I think so. We actually have a couple already in the queue. And given that we're 10 minutes out from the end of this discussion, I'm just going to run through those. So the first one, which I think is tangentially related to what you guys were both just talking about, is from Carlos. I'm summarizing the question a bit for brevity, which is, can you discuss whether policy coordination among transnational pseudo-regulatory bodies, such as the World Bank or IMF, would be helpful in mitigating future cyber attacks, and how so?
Stuart, do you want to take that one?
Sure, I'll be glad to take it. I'm not sure. Yes, there's value in having similar standards, but if you think that regulation is a bad way to achieve cybersecurity, internationally negotiated regulation is even slower and less likely to keep up with the steps that need to be taken. So I'm not sure that coordination of regulatory standards is as important as coordination of response to the transnational crime, so that we know that actually other institutions will track the attacker, track their funds, track their Bitcoin, take action against people. The more that you can have coordination on the penalties and the law enforcement side of stopping attacks, I think the better. And I have this is me in my most Panglossian. I actually have hope that the Chinese and maybe even the Russians could agree with us that people who attack financial institutions need to be tracked down wherever they are and brought to justice, because Chinese banks are at risk, Russian banks are at risk, and getting the Treasury and Finance Secretaries of all of those countries together on coordinated response to certain kinds of cybersecurity attacks, I still think is a promising approach internationally.
I would also add that, I think that we really need to change our view and our culture to sort of acknowledge that the frameworks and the sort of systems in which we all work, including the international system, isn't set up to deal with the cyber attacks of tomorrow or today, honestly, because the internet is, is all across the world, right? It's interconnected. It's open, mostly. And we need to acknowledge that reality and stop thinking about regulations and laws as if the internet stops at our border.
That's a great point. And I would say I am disappointed, but maybe not surprised by the lack of imagination about how to deal with some of these problems. China already has its own internet, and they don't need us. And yet we let them operate on our open and global internet, which really isn't open and global anymore. The Russians are moving in the same direction. I think it's a fair question. Since our adversaries are already doing this, maybe we should just embrace it, recognize that there is a Balkanized internet, and work with like-minded countries to create one that is both relatively open and doesn't allow bad actors from Russia and China, North Korea, to get on and have free access to the open global system that we've created. I know that the lobbyists from Silicon Valley have heart attacks when I say stuff like that, but that's because they like feeding the illusion because it's good for the bottom line. It's never going to happen, and we might as well start recognizing it.
Well, you know, I don't know about whether we should sort of give up our I would see that as sort of a giving up on our ideals, right? Our country was based on the concept of freedom and openness and trying to include as many people in our, you know, great experiment as possible. We've always been supportive of including everyone we could in all of the things that that we do, and sort of sharing our thinking across the world. And I think it would be a mistake to close off and follow the paths of China or Russia in terms of balkanizing the internet. I think that, I disagree that I think that it's not the direction we should go, but I also think that too, it's probably not feasible at this point. Even in the most secure systems right now, adversaries get in. So how would we possibly keep everybody out if we were to create a system that is theoretically closed? I'm not sure that that's the direction we want to go. You know, I'm a keep your friends close, keep your enemies closer kind of person.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm ready to do that. But I agree that no one has asked the question, how could we do that if we chose to do it? But I think it's time to ask, could we do it if we chose to do it? That issue we're not going to resolve today.
So I have one more question, and then we can probably wrap up with closing remarks. Something that we've touched on but not really discussed is the fact that the Colonial Pipeline breach was paid in Bitcoin, which elicited strong reactions from government entities and officials, the news media, and cryptocurrency experts. My question is regulation of cryptocurrencies a potential solution to inhibiting actors from extracting ransoms from their victims? And to what extent does the perfect traceability and auditability of certain blockchain-based cryptos like Bitcoin actually help law enforcement in recovering ransoms?
I'll start and then Tatiana can finish. Yeah, we're going to get more cryptocurrency regulation. It was proposed at the tail end of the Trump administration and is being continued. The same proposal is being continued by Treasury in this administration. Know your customer rules for people subject to U.S. jurisdiction who are handling cryptocurrency. I think, you know, at least to my relatively untutored eye, something that would reach international agreement on treating tumblers and mixers as essentially money launderers whose business really doesn't have much of a business justification would make the theoretical traceability of Bitcoin much more real. We're also seeing, you know, the Justice Department and the rest of the government has begun to get creative about finding ways to defeat the Bitcoin incentives. They were able to seize big chunks of the ransomware that was paid by Colonial Pipeline, take it back from the guy who received it by getting hold of his private key. We're going to see more of that. I don't think that's a solution, but it certainly feels good every time it happens. And it probably does discourage attackers if they can't actually get paid. So yeah, we're going to see both regulation and more aggressive and more creative law enforcement.
I agree. I think the biggest issue here is that Treasury, for one, will have to, I think, finally reckon with, you know, what they consider Bitcoin, right? Like, is it a currency? Are we, you know, sort of finally going to deal with the big question there? And then also, you know, cyber attacks are not caused by you know, Bitcoin or cryptocurrency. It is merely a form of payment. And does it make it easier? Yes. But would ransomware stop if Bitcoin didn't exist? No. People can pay in cold hard cash. Is it, again, more difficult? Yes. But I think we need to sort of address the underlying issues. And if we address those, then most likely you would and improve enforcement, then you would really address the issue. But I wanted to also take on this question from Jeffrey here in the chat about government's role in protecting against cyber attacks versus private individuals and businesses, because I think it's an interesting question. I would say to you, Jeffrey, that this is an all hands on deck situation. We are right now being attacked from all sides, and everyone is doing their best. I would argue, big companies, small companies, state and locals, federal government agencies, they're all trying to improve our system and improve the cybersecurity of the country and then their respective piece of that. So the question, I think, is not whether the government has or should have a prominent role, but rather what role it should play and which specific actions they should take. For example, I think it is imperative on the federal government to set minimum standards, right, where we can be assured that certain companies aren't taking shortcuts and aren't leaving us open to threats, and the private companies should absolutely, and individuals absolutely, should take more steps to improve their cybersecurity as well. So I think it's not an either or. I think it's all of the above.
Yeah, and just to close from my end, I think the lesson of the last 6 months is pretty much what Tatiana said. It's no longer going to be adequate to say, I think there are downsides to regulation and therefore we should do nothing, because too many people now feel aggrieved by cybersecurity failures make that a credible response. So if you're talking to clients, I wouldn't encourage them to think that they're going to beat regulation by getting the chamber to show up and fight it. This is a different administration. And there is a different spirit abroad in the land. That doesn't mean that regulation is going to be really aggressive. I don't think it will be. But we are going to see a much greater and, as I've said a couple of times, a much more stick-in-the-closet approach to cybersecurity from the government over the next 5 years compared to the last 10.
Yeah, and I'll close with this. You know, I will even say that having worked with the chamber at the commission, even they are supportive of some of these sort of some of these reforms that can improve all of our cybersecurity. Because I think we generally need to come to a reckoning before a massive cyber attack cripples our energy grid or releases, heaven forbid, like nuclear weapons into the hands of criminals. That we need to do something. We need to do this better. And so, you know, I think that there's a general consensus that's the case, and I think we need to take it and run with it. So thanks for saying, Colton, thanks for having us.
Yeah, this was a real pleasure. And Colton, if you can speak, please take us out.
Thank you. Thank you both for joining us. We are very grateful to you both for taking the time today and for the insightful discussion on this important topic. We welcome listener feedback by email at rtp@regproject.org. Thank you for joining us. This concludes today's call.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.